insert disc 2.
Retro Gaming Radio, 2006. A different hobby than sitting with your ass strapped up to Xbox Live. God, I love Generation Gaming. This is retarded. Why am I reading this list?
Hey, that's Pikachu.
Keep it retro. Hello, folks. Welcome to the May 2006 edition of Retro Gaming Radio. This is Shane R. Monroe, your host. Welcome to the program. Well, folks, after last month's hiatus and best of show, which, by the way, was received very well, thank you for all your great happy letters that think that that's some of the greatest stuff since sliced bread. And thanks to Flair, Fernando Garcia, our intern and Retro Gaming Radio information specialist. He put together the contents of the show, and I went ahead and produced it. And it was great. It was a great show. Lots of people loved it. But now we're back to the real deal, back to the new shows. And this month, great stuff. You're going to absolutely love it. First off, of course, we have a new editorial commentary. We have our regular Bits and Bytes segment. We finish up our interview, our incredible interview with Keith Robinson of Intellivision Lives. And we have an update on the GP2X. We're going to talk to you more about what's going on over there. And finally, we're going to have not one, but two flashbacks for you this month, an 8-bit and a 16-bit. The 16-bit is on Super Frog for the Amiga. I've been playing a lot of platformers on the Nintendo DS lately, and it hailed me all the way back to Super Frog, and I wanted to share some of my feelings about that. The 8-bit flashback, well, you're going to have to keep listening because that's kind of a surprise. In any event, all this, so much more this month on the May edition of Retro Gaming Radio. This month's editorial commentary, I wanted to take a moment and talk about what I call tangibility. I know what you're thinking. You're thinking, man, that's a pretty far departure from classic gaming. What are you talking about, Shane? But let me have a moment to explain. The popularity of Xbox Live, all of the classic games that are being shoved over to Xbox Live, the up-and-coming virtual console for the Nintendo Revolution or Wii or whatever the hell they're going to call it in the United States, the Steams, the other virtual ownership things, even in some respect, games that are subscription-based, right? I mean, EverQuest or whatever the hell the latest ones are, World of Warcraft, all of these titles, all of these games, all of these delivery systems have one thing in common. They're finite. World of Warcraft ain't going to run forever, no matter how much money it makes. Eventually, it'll go away. Steam or Half-Life 2 eventually will go away. You have to make room for what's coming next. You know, Xbox Live ain't going to be around forever. Is Xbox Live going to be around in 20 years? Who knows? However, I can go out and get a Robotron cabinet still. They're still around after 20, 25 years, right? Because there's an air of tangibility. If I were to buy a music CD, let me just pick one out of thin air. Journey's Greatest Hits. Okay, that's an old CD to begin with. In 10 years... 20 years, there's still going to be something around that plays CDs. You know, I'm sure we'll have HD, Blu-ray, something or another audio that has like 7 billion gigabytes per disc. Something is going to play that CD. Right? That stands to reason. The format's not going to go away. But the tangibles, the CDs, the disc-based media, you know, I still have Legacy of the Ancients sitting right here. Right here, right now, I have sitting in front of me the album cover, cool Legacy of the Ancients game box with the disc still inside. And I'll bet you, if I pulled my Commodore 64 out of the closet and plugged it in, this disc would still work. That's tangible. If I want to listen to Debbie Gibson's Out of the Blue, I can go in my closet right now and pull the disc out. Now, sure, it's sitting on my white box. I got an MP3 of it.
White Box might crash. Drive might go. Debbie Gibson may not be available on iTunes 2007, whatever. Right? Lack of interest, probably. Fact is, I have something tangible I can return to. When I record something off television, let's say I record Lost, right? Now, Lost is a hot show. Chances are likely I'm going to get a DVD in 6 months or less of season two of Lost. I'll be able to get it on a tangible medium. But what if you don't? What if you are watching a show like Millennium or a show that gets a short run, you know, Commander in Chief? I don't think that's going to be on disc anytime soon. So how do you watch it again? What, wait for reruns? They're not going to syndicate that. It's not even syndicatable. Wasn't 100 episodes. How do you watch that show? Right? You go to eBay and you buy a bootleg of it. That's how you watch the show. Why? Because it's not tangible. Right? If you want to play some weird-ass game from 1980, I tried to think of a weird-ass game that came out in 1980, but just suddenly slipped my mind. If you try to play that, what are your choices? Well, you could go find a cabinet, an arcade cabinet, or a motherboard or game board of it. Or you can play it emulated in MAME, illegally, of course, because you don't own it. Is it going to show up on Xbox Live? No. Is it going to show up on the Revolution console, the Wii virtual console? No. It's not by Sega. It's not from Hudson Soft. It's not from Nintendo. So it's not going to show up on the virtual console. It's an old game that nobody played but you. I still haven't gotten a good Starship One emulation yet. I'm still waiting. I got to go find a cab for that if I want to play it. All right, that was a cool game. What can I tell you? I played it at the Wenatchee Liberty Cinema. They had it in their lobby. Played a lot of that, too. Cool control, the yoke controller. Anyway, beside the point. My point is that we need to start thinking about historical preservation. That's what MAME claimed it was. Remember back in the old days? MAME was a project dedicated to the preservation of arcade games because these game machines fall apart. These game machines get lost in time. You can't find a Starship One machine anywhere to buy. So they did this to preserve. I respect that. I think MAME has sort of lost its roots now, but that's a whole other story. Xbox Live is not about historical preservation. Xbox Live is about milking Robotron for subscriptions for a while. It's not going to be there forever. You can't download Robotron and keep it. You can't dump it to a disc and then run it over to your computer and play it. Because that Xbox is going to go away. Guaranteed. Hell, the last Xbox is already gone, basically. Right? The 360 slid in, taking its spot. So, who knows how long that's going to be on Xbox Live. As long as it makes money, and as long as it makes good financial sense, you'll see it. When it's no longer vogue, when, again, the fad of retro gaming and PC gaming on a console wears thin, these things are going to go away. There will be no more Robotron for you. And you'll be forced to go back to MAME or some other program or emulator to get that. And you're not going to be able to do it legally because you never got to own Robotron because it was on Xbox Live. You never got to own Mario Kart NES because it was on the Revolution virtual console. Oh yeah, we're going to let you back it up to a flash drive. Yeah, great. How long is that flash drive going to last? And where can I use that flash drive? I can use it in the Nintendo Wii. This is just all speculation, folks. We don't know how this is going to work out. From what I understand, though, you're going to be able to go online and acquire a game like the original Donkey Kong. Some of it may be free, some of it may be pay, whatever. But when you get it, you're supposed to be able to download it to your local machine so that you can play it locally without having to be online or without having to go through the motions again. Well, that's still not tangible. You are talking about that game being available for that period of time. And they've already talked about expiring content. So it's going to be just like downloading a movie that you, quote, buy online, and it's gone in 3 days. These aren't tangible. A lot of people think that the internet is going to solve the tangibility problems. Right now, you can go to Google Video, and you can find clips of TV shows that aren't available on disc. They're not available for you to buy on tape. They're not available, period. But through Google, the magic of Google Video, you can relive that for a short period of time. But you can't save it. You can't archive it. I've already seen one case where I lost something that was online. And it happens all the time here. People submit articles to me, news articles about some classic gaming-related thing for me to talk about here on Bits and Bytes. And guess what? Within a month, a short-term period of a month, I go to look at these articles to talk about them. They're gone. The link you followed is no longer valid. Please use the search. You use the search, it's not there. That is a dumping. That is a recycling of our heritage, of our information. You know, I saw a video, and I'm sure I've talked about this, and I'll probably post it here too. It's still relevant from the forums, of this kid opening his Nintendo 64 on Christmas Day. And it's one of the funniest videos I've ever seen. They slow it down when the kid's like, yeah. It's the best video ever. I haven't been to the forums recently. Go to the forums and search for, I don't know what you'd search for, N64 video maybe. And this kid, it's the funniest video I ever saw. And I was talking to some guys at work about it, and I said, hey, you guys have got to see this video. This is the funniest thing ever. This kid's opening a Nintendo 64, and he's like having an epileptic seizure over it. So I pull it up. This video is no longer available. And I lost my mind. I spent an hour digging through Google, digging through every search engine I could try to find this damn video. Because I didn't save it. It was on freaking YouTube or something where I couldn't save the video. I had no tangible means of taking it down and keeping it. So I lost it. Fortunately, I found somebody who'd mirrored it on a site. I mean, it took me forever to find this thing. And that guy's going to go away. You know as well as I do. This stuff doesn't last. The internet is a recycle bin. It fills up for a while and then somebody empties it. That's the way we're treating stuff. That's the way we're treating our gaming. That's the way we're treating our society. Everything is shifting away from tangible to this virtual crap. And I'm telling you, it may sound like a good deal. I know what you're thinking. Some people have already told me, well, the virtual console will be great because they're going to have games that I can't buy or games that cost $100 on eBay. I'll finally be able to play again. That's all fine and well. You get to play it again, but then it's gone again. What about in 5 years when the revolution's gone or Xbox Live is gone or whatever? It's gone. And in 10 years, you're going to be yearning to play that damn thing again, and it's not going to be available. Because when it was available, you weren't willing to spend $50 on the disc, or you weren't willing to make some footwork and go down and pick it up from, you know, the Salvation Army or Goodwill or whatever. There is nothing. Things are starting to become all virtual. And like I said, a lot of people think it's the best thing ever, especially Generation Gimme. You know why? They love disposability. We've talked about this on previous shows. Flair, look it up for me. Find out where I talked about disposability, because I think that's important to tie in with this episode. Disposability is insane. The concept of buying back video games. I mean, think about that. I mean, when you were like a Commodore 64 freak and you bought a game, usually it was a decent game, that's part of the problem, but if the game was even remotely decent, were you like racing off to sell it? I can honestly not remember actually selling any of my Commodore 64 games. There was something about having it. You know, there was something about owning the game and keeping the game and having it on your shelf. Or, you know, that's one of those things where, you know, you look at like piracy today. People, you know, say to me, well, why do you buy games when you can pirate them? I like having the box on my shelf. I've got this whole stack of Nintendo DS boxes. Okay, probably shouldn't have bought some of them because they sucked. But there's something special about having that shelf service, you know, that you look over and there's a stack of games. It's like, wow, that's cool. But that's something that the current generation has no interest in preservation. It's about getting the game, finishing the game, disposing of the game. There is no emotional investment It's a turnkey thing. It's like, it's that lack of soul. Flair, once again, help me out here. What show did I talk about video games and certain things having soul? The Dreamcast has a soul, the PlayStation doesn't. Prime example. You know? The GP2X has soul. The Nintendo DS really doesn't. There's a ton of ways to look at this, but no matter how you pare it down, we are going to lose our heritage. We are going to lose our roots. Only the top-selling games get remade every single console, right? Guarantee that every console is going to get a port of Halo from Microsoft. Every console that Microsoft puts out is going to get a version of Halo. You're not going to care about the first version of Halo because you've got Halo 17 out that you can play that's got even more graphics and even more polygons and even more screen resolution. So there's no reason for you to go back and revisit it. But there are titles that you're going to fall in love with. There are titles that you're going to want to preserve. There are titles, there are things right now. I'm tickled to death that I have an original Archon for the Commodore 64. Do I play it? No. I've got it emulated. But at some point in time, I may not be able to play it emulated. At some point in time, it may not be available. At some point in time, I may never be able to get this thing again. There's a magic. There's a historical value in owning something. Something that you can put in your hand. Something you can take out and look at. Ask real music aficionados whether they would like to download music or own a CD. How do you think CD sales are still happening with iTunes and all of these other things, with virtual ownership of music? Explain to me how CDs are still even for sale. How does the CD market even stand a chance? You know why? Because there are enough people out there that want the liner notes, that want the inserts, that want the special thanks go out to my family, God, the guy down the street, all these people I thank for helping me make this album. I mean, I remember, this is going to be a brutal segue, bear with me here. Remember it back, way back when you went to the store and you bought a CD, right? Then all of a sudden came Columbia House. Anybody who's been around long enough knows exactly what I'm talking about. 12 CDs for the price of one penny, and you only got to buy four more. So if you do the math, you're getting a good deal. Well, I was part of like every music club I could get my paws on. BMG, Columbia House, because, again, I wanted to see CDs on my shelf. And, of course, back then you couldn't copy it. But, you know, there were still tapes. There were still other means of getting music. But there was something special about having the CD. There was something special about opening the CD and pulling out a little booklet and seeing pictures, seeing thank you notes, seeing lyrics. And some people are saying, well, you know what, you get all that on the internet, you don't need it in a CD. That's just not true. It's just not true. You're getting watered, filtered information. Those of you, everybody has something that they're passionate about. If you're passionate about music, you're not going to download music, you're going to go buy a CD, rip it yourself, of course, so that you have an electronic copy, but you want the CD. I know tons of people that are like that. It's like, I could buy the album on iTunes, but screw that. I'm going to go buy the CD because I want feature X. I want the insert. I want the bonus thing. A lot of CDs, a lot of music that's coming out have hybrids now where it has a music video on it. Okay, you're saying, well, I could watch that on the internet. Yeah, but you can't keep it. You can't save it. You get to watch it and it's gone. You get to watch it in 120 by 100 postage stamp style graphics. You don't have anything quality. You don't have anything you can take home. Nothing you can keep. And again, as soon as that artist goes under the hill and nobody's interested anymore, bam, it's gone from YouTube. Bam, it's gone from Google Video. Bam, it's gone from the internet. Because that's what it's all about. Recycling. Making more money. Bringing out new stuff all the time. Because you can't be satisfied with what you have. You have to have something new. That's the American way. So, back to the BMG thing, I quickly learned the secret of Columbia House and BMG. A lot of people today don't even know this. Columbia House was the original Walmart. And in saying that, I mean, Columbia House struck a deal with BMI, EMI, and all these other recording agencies, all the big ones. And they said, listen, we want to offer our customers a cheaper product than what you're putting out. So here's what we're going to do. We're going to license the content from you. You're going to let us have rights to all the songs. You're going to let us have rights to the cover art. And we are going to manufacture our own version of the CD. And if you have any recollection of these old school days, there was a lot of times when you would have Billy Joel's Glass Houses and your friend would have Billy Joel's Glass Houses, and the CDs were completely different. The cover art was different. There was no insert, your copy didn't have any lyrics in it. It basically had a one-sided jewel case insert with Billy Joel on the front of it. Even the CD looked different. That's because BMG and Columbia House started making their own CDs. And so, in order to give you 12, did you really think that they could afford to give you 12 CDs for a penny if they weren't managing to cut the production cost down to almost nothing? That's how they did it. They rented the music for pennies on the dollar. They made their own CDs, cut all the quality stuff out of it to save the dollar. And then they passed that along to you. A lot of people didn't care. Oh, I got the CD. Well, no, not really. You got some interpretation of the CD. Yeah, the music might be the same, but who knows? Who knows if BMG's or Columbia House's facilities were up to the standards of Sony or up to the standards of, you know, Artista or whatever. Take your pick. My point is longevity, heritage, and tangibility. Things are coming at a very quick rate. But there are some things that you need to hold on to. There are some things that require we don't just let it go. Subscription-based gaming, that makes me mental. Aside from my regular bitches about double-dipping, paying for a game and then paying to play it, all that stuff. What happens when World of Warcraft goes under? Now, you could say, oh no, EverQuest has been around forever, so World of Warcraft's going to be around forever. No, it's not. In 20 years, you're going to want to revisit World of Warcraft. How are you going to do that? You're going to want to revisit EverQuest. You're going to say, man, you know, I remember when I was, you know, 18, and I just got out of school, it was summer, and I had this great game called EverQuest, or insert your, you know, massive role-playing game here. It's like, man, that was so much fun. I wish we could do that again. And you're going to look, and guess what? It ain't there anymore. It's gone. Blizzard ain't going to keep World of Warcraft open for 20 years. They may have, you know, Universe of Warcraft or some crap like that, but you ain't going to be able to pull out your World of Warcraft disc and throw that in and play it. It's a loss of tangibility. It's a loss of things that help define generations. I mean, I know this sounds like I'm getting all weird on you guys, but no, but bear with me. There are things, period pieces. Film is a good example. You can easily tell, if you take out an old TV show, no matter how great the special effects are, how do you tell when that show was made? You look at the cars. You look at the telephones. Does it got a rotary dial? 70s, right? You have means of getting to these period pieces. As things go virtual, as things continue to move to a disposable market, these things are not going to be available unless you make them available. Good example. I'll give you a good TV example. You ever see the show Cold Case? I know it's a chick show. My wife watches it. But the cool thing about Cold Case is it's got really good music, because it always goes back like 20 years. They show, like, you know, here was the case as it was 20 years ago, and then 20 years later, we're going to finally solve it. Who cares, right? Whatever. But the music in Cold Case is excellent. It's so good, in fact, their website actually has track listings, basically, for every episode so that you know what they played. Great music. I mean, good, classic, old-school music. I mean, they play Creedence. They play, you know, they play all this good stuff. What do you think is going to happen when Cold Case, if it does, comes to DVD? The same thing that happened to every other show that doesn't want to spend $10 million in music licensing rights. They're going to replace the music. You're not ever going to get to see the pilot episode of The Greatest American Hero. You're never going to get to hear The Greatest American Hero with Help Me Rhonda on it. Why? Because they replaced the music. And the only tangible version of it you can now own is a DVD that's broken, that doesn't have it as you remembered it. Until recently, Star Wars. You never got to have the original Star Wars. Apparently, they're going to finally put that out on DVD from the original theatrical cut. But these are the sort of... I mean, people don't understand, well, why do you care so much that Han shot first? Who cares? Dude, it's part of our history. That's what filmmakers don't get when they go back and tamper with things. This is what... When you're playing Joust on Xbox Live, you're not playing Joust. You're playing an interpretation of Joust. Okay, it may play close to the same. Can you slide through the little hole? Can you slide between the little platforms like you could in the original arcade game? Can you kill the pterodactyl like you could in the original arcade game? Probably not. And why is that? Because it's not the real game. It's an interpretation of the game. You're going to remember playing Joust with a background when it never had one. These are things that destroy the historical value of something. And don't think I'm picking on Microsoft, because if the Revolution does it, or Wii or whatever, if Nintendo does it with the Virtual Console, I'm going to bitch at them too. There seems to be zero desire to preserve. Otherwise, our lives wouldn't be moving so quickly to virtual ownership. Before long, you're not going to be able to own anything. And you're going to be paying along the way every single time to use things that you should have been able to preserve. You know, nothing pisses me off more than buying a piece of software and in a year you can't use it anymore. Because you never really bought the software. You bought a license to use it for a year and then it crapped out. Okay, so maybe you don't want any more updates. Maybe you're satisfied with the product as is. You buy the product, it's yours. You're allowed to use it as is. Okay, so they make 10 million updates in the next 10 years. Right? You're not paying for them, so you don't get them, fine. You should still be able to use what you bought. Right? And that's what I'm talking about. You buy Donkey Kong on the Nintendo Wii, and it sits there, and it times out in a month. You're only allowed to play it for a month. Or you have access to their entire back catalog for $14.95 a month. Well, at the end of the month, you have nothing to show for $14.95. Nothing. Nothing tangible. At all. Well, you have your memory of playing the game for that month, but you have nothing to show for it. And I think this is a proliferation of a problem that we've got as Americans, as a human race, our desire to extend forward and dump whatever we had yesterday in favor of what we had tomorrow. And this is the sort of thing this show is based on. This is the sort of thing that we've been begging for. We've been begging for legal ways to run old ROMs. We've been begging for legal music downloads. But they can't do it in a manner that doesn't piss people off. Okay, people like iTunes because a monkey can do it, literally. I've actually seen video of a monkey running iTunes and downloading music to their iPod. That's why iTunes is popular. It's not because the encoding or the protection scheme on it is nice and convenient. Well, you can stream it to 5 other users in the house. Great. What about if I want to take it to work? Well, you can burn it to a disk. Well, great. I don't have any discs. I got a flash drive. I'm part of the next generation here. I don't have physical media. I have flashable media. How do I get it on there? Well, you don't. Great. I can't install iTunes at work, so guess what? I don't get to listen to this music at work because I'm not willing to burn a disc. It's crazy. We allow ourselves to be taken in by convenience. And we don't see the big picture. We don't see that we're throwing money to something that's intangible. Anyway, I don't want to sit here and harp on it for too much longer. I'm starting to tread old ground, and I don't want to do that and bore the crap out of everybody. I think that it's important that we look at what we are doing as a society, how relatively temporary information has become a main staple. I mean, what Encyclopedia Britannica, they, as far as I know, and somebody can correct me if I'm wrong, but I was reading somewhere, you can't buy an Encyclopedia Britannica set anymore. You can't actually go out and buy, 17 volumes of the Encyclopedia Britannica. You can buy a disc with a subscription that lets you log into Encyclopedia Britannica and use it online, but you can't buy the books anymore. let's say the end of the world comes, right? Electricity is all gone. Think of The Stand from Stephen King. The electricity's gone. What happens if you need to, know something? Well, we don't have books anymore. It's all online that you pay $14.95 for. Well, guess what? I can't get online. How am I supposed to get the information? You don't. You know? The end of the world happens. I mean, this is extreme, but you get the idea. The end of the world happens, and you know, you hook up a portable generator, you have a computer turned on, you just want something to do. So you got this computer booted up. Well, guess what? You ain't playing Half-Life 2 because you can't make a connection to Steam because Steam's dead. They got nuked first, hopefully. Right? I mean, it sounds extreme and it sounds excessive. And it's like, oh, you know what? The end of the world, whatever, Shane. You're a dumbass. Not true. I just want you to think about it logically. The way things move, the way things turn over. I mean, I've seen information turn over more than, you know, actors in the Batman suit, man. Literally, it's just like, what the hell? I was here 5 minutes ago and the page is gone. It's untangible. I mean, anything I really want anymore, if I see a really cool video, like the Internet is for Porn video from the World of Warcraft thing, the first thing I do is I find a way to get a copy of it and save it. Because you know what? In 6 months, when all the hype is gone, the mirrors drop off, it stops being indexed to Google Video, whatever, it's gone. You don't get it again. Maybe, sometimes you might get it. If it's really popular, it might hang out for a while. But you have to get a tangible copy, because it's gone. That's where we're going to, folks. Let's not let that happen. Let's not support the concept. Let's demand that we get taken care of. Let's demand that as consumers, we have more power than you can possibly imagine. If you strike me down, I'll become more powerful than you can possibly imagine. And that's true. Strike down the consumer, we can become powerful. You piss us off, we can make a difference. You ain't going to make no difference not buying gas today, because if you don't buy it today, you're going to have to buy it tomorrow. You know, don't say today I'm not buying any video games from Electronic Arts, but tomorrow you pick up Madden 07. It didn't work that way. You know, think about your own ideals. Think about in 20 years when you have children or your children are old enough to appreciate or whatever. You want to be able to show them Archon. How are you going to do it? You want your child to see what you... If you want your child to see Halo 2 because that's what's important to you right now, and in 20 years, 25 years, you have a kid and you say, hey, you know, I played this great game I want to share with you. I'd like to sit down with you and play a game of Halo. Halo's gone, man. Ain't no way to play Halo. It's gone. It's gone. And that's what we're going to, folks. A society where things are gone. I'm not pleased with it. What do you guys think? Go to our message forums at monroeworld.com/forums or get a link off the retrogamingradio.com website. Tell us what you think about disposability. Are you one of those people that can't get enough of disposability? As long as I can get it online today and play it for a month, and when I'm done with it, I don't care if I can play it again in 20 years? Or are you one of the people like me that think that preservation is all but a lost art? Let us know on the forums. Let us know what you think. And hopefully you found this little rant of mine enjoyable. Haven't ranted for a while. Feels good. Feels good. This month marks the return of the GP2X segment. The GP2X, of course, is the quirky little Korean handheld that is totally open source, runs on Linux, and offers some of the absolute best in portable emulation and open source stuff. We got lots to talk about. A lot of times I get asked, you know, is the GP2X ready yet? Is the GP2X ready yet? You know, should I order? I'm ready to jump the ship. I'm ready to grab one, but I'm still a little freaked out about the problems that, you know, people have been talking about with the firmware and the headphone jack and all of these other problems we keep hearing about. I really want one, but if I'm going to spend, you know, $180, $160, whatever, you know, I got to be sure that it's ready. Well, if you've been waiting for the jump order, I am very confident at this point in time that if you go ahead and pick up a GP2X, you will not be disappointed. Since we've talked last, the new firmware, the latest upgrade in firmware from Game Park Holdings for the GP2X is now available. 2.0 is the latest revision of the firmware, and they fix most of the things that I had severe problems with. And this is a quick overview. A lot of people have already upgraded, you probably already know about it, but for those of you who are still on the fence as to whether to get one or not, Let me tell you what they have fixed. The first thing when you turn on a GP2X that turns you off is the fact that it took 30-something seconds to load, 38 seconds, 40 seconds to boot. That time, thanks to the firmware 2.0, has been reduced to anywhere between 7 and 9 seconds. That's perfectly acceptable in my book. 7 seconds, 8 seconds, 9 seconds to get from power on to the menu and get started playing, I'm good to go with that. Battery life was one of the other huge concerns with the GP2X. Battery life has now been extended thanks to several different battery saving features. The CPU is now dynamically turned up and down based on where you're at. If you're sitting at a menu, you don't need to have a 200 megahertz CPU running. They turn it down. So in a lot of things that do not require a lot of payload, they have reduced the CPU usage. That's a great thing. That extends the battery life considerably. Most of the emulators and packages out there give you the opportunity to up or down clock your CPU based on your needs. For example, you may not need 200 megahertz to run Pac-Man. You may, in fact, only need 150 megahertz. So inside of MAME, which we're going to talk more about, you can actually tune down the CPU to use less battery. That's a good thing. So battery life has been extended. It's perfectly, as long as you're willing to invest in some decent batteries, you know, 2500 milliamp nickel metal hydride batteries, you're going to be fine. Mine last about 5 hours, depending on what I'm doing. Along with that, there are modes of other things, like the video player, for example. You can actually turn into battery saving mode, and it will try to compensate and produce a lesser picture, lesser quality video playback, but still conserve your battery. So there are tons of things like that that really make it worthwhile. The next thing that people had a complaint about, which I never quite understood, was the LCD quality. Some people said that it ran hot. Some people said that it ran cold. Some people said they didn't like the scan lines. Some people said they liked the scan lines. There was no way to please everybody. Well, with the new 2.0 firmware, there's an LCD. It's very simple, an LCD tweaking utility that lets you run a slider back and forth to find the perfect balance for the LCD. Do I know exactly what it does? No. But I know that you can dial in what you feel you are happy with. The other thing that people really had a problem with was the USB plug-in. A lot of people don't have, I don't know how this works out, but people don't want to take the SD card out of the GP2X and plug it into a card reader in their PC. They want to be able to plug the GP2X directly in with the USB cable and use it as a mounted drive. Big problems with that previously. Apparently, with the 2.0 firmware, they have more or less completely fixed that with the problems they were having under Windows XP and things like that. So that's been squared away. A lot of people had problems with the joystick during video gaming play. It seemed to be a little touchy at the angles, at the diagonals. So you'd be playing a game and you'd think you were going right, but you were really going down into the right, and Pac-Man would take a lower dive down one of the tubes going down. I don't know what they did. I thought that would be a hardware issue that would have to be fixed, but somehow it seems to be fixed in software. The games that I had problems with no longer seem to be affected. The joystick sensitivity problem appears to be fixed. I still am not a big fan of the nub, the thumb nub that's used on top, so I still recommend the Dave C replacement cap. If you go to GP2X's forums and search for the Dave C replacement cap, you'll see what I'm talking about. This one's still a lot more comfortable, Dave C's cap. The unit is no longer considered first edition. If you go and you look, the first edition sign is gone off of GP2X when you buy them new. And I do believe one of the hardware problems that they had mentioned was that the headphone jack liked to break off. There was apparently a run of GP2Xs where the soldering system on the headphone jack was poor and shoddy. If you pushed the headphone jack in too far, it snapped off. And it rattled around inside your GP2X. So, as I understand it, that fabrication process has been repaired. I will assume that the second generation GP2Xs are shipping that way. That should take care of that problem. What else is there? The file system has been dramatically improved. You can actually, inside of the Explorer utility, it used to be you could just browse around your card. How useful? Not. But now you can copy, move, and delete items around your card without actually having to take your card out or plugging it into a USB. The NAND memory, which is the built-in like 64 megs of like non-volatile memory, used to be locked down where you couldn't write to it. Now, if you would like to, you can actually move something into that NAND and store it there permanently. If you don't have a card with you, or you have a little utility that you use all the time and you have lots of SD cards, you can now move that little utility into NAND memory and use it. That's also cool. What else can I tell you? That surmises the bigger portion of the problems that people have with the GP2X. Now, thanks to the new firmware, there are many applications, or like the Dr. MD, the Mega Drive Genesis emulator, for example. The menus now flicker like mad because the way that the GP2X is controlling the CPU or whatever. In any event, it only happens in the menu. It doesn't happen in the game, but that can still turn some people off whenever there's a big firmware upgrade that some things may not work properly. The hiccuping that a lot of people have claimed, including myself, that have seen, you're playing the game and it hiccups for like a half a second and then it goes back into play. That seemed to be something that was related to the CramFS file system. That's sort of an interim build of the new firmware. It was an open source designed by the community. It was a lot better than the 1.4 firmware, but it had some kind of weird things in it. I've not seen my games hiccup since then. So that's a great thing. So the firmware 2.0 upgrade, in my opinion, is the defining upgrade that now makes the GP2X a ready-to-go product. We're ready to buy. So if you're waiting for the jump order, go get it, because I think we're ready to go. And I'm sure that all the new GP2Xs will be shipping with the new firmware. So there you have it. Probably the more significant emulator updates since we've last talked, of course, is MAME. And I don't remember the last time we spoke if MAME had a configuration save tool. There are two problems with MAME. One was that there was no way to store your configurations, and the other one was there were no sound sample support. And the guy that's doing the MAME port for the GP2X has absolutely no interest in doing sound sample support, and in fact, he gets all upset if you even bring it up on the forums. So enjoy not having sound in Star Trek SOS now. Enjoy not having a full set of sounds in Nintendo games. It's very disappointing to me. And I'm almost sad that I gave the guy so much cash. I mean, I gave him, a triple sawbuck for for his contributions with MAME 2X. And now I'm kind of disappointed that he's not listening to dozens of people that want sound sample support. But let's not talk about the negative things. Let's talk about the good things. In the later versions of MAME, I think we're at 2.2 right now, for your GP2X, you have the complete ability to save configurations. This is brilliant. This is what caused me not to play MAME on the GP2X. You now can set controls. You can set sound and video emulation preference. You can set all sorts of goodies, including clock speed. So Robotron doesn't play right to me unless it's at 250 megahertz. So I can upsample to 250, and I can save that configuration. So the next time I run MAME, I don't have to reset everything. So now every time I play a game, I set it up exactly the way I want it, save the configuration, and I'm good.
You play Astro Smash and you get 5,000 points, it unlocks a TV commercial or that. So right. What we did was we did some unlockables on some of the unreleased games, and we put 3 unreleased games on the PlayStation, and then we put a different 3 unreleased games on the Xbox. So those have different unlockables. Now on the GameCube, since we figured that's for a different market, we put all of those 6 unreleased games on the GameCube.
You don't think that kind of pissed Sony or Microsoft off if they gave you gave the competitor more than you gave them?
Well, Sony and the Xbox and the PlayStation, like I say, in a certain way, Sony, the PlayStation 2 and the Xbox are competitors. GameCube is a different market. The people look at the Nintendo as a different market. The head-to-head competition is between PlayStation 2 and Xbox. GameCube is kind of its own little thing off to the side. And so they don't really look at it as much as the competitor. They look at the other one. And plus, they had a year head start.
Right.
They had a Christmas before GameCube did. GameCube was a later project. So at that point, we figured they had gotten a head start. They had got their exclusivity. They've gotten all that. The GameCube, now playing catch-up a year later, what can we give them? We can give them all the unreleased. So they get a little bonus that way. and of course now we're working on the DS, which
tell me all about the DS version, please.
Well, the DS, when I saw the DS, I immediately said this is the Intellivision platform, because like I say, no console has enough buttons to duplicate those 15 buttons and that directional disc. But then along came the DS that had this touch screen. I said, there we go. The overlay, because the Intellivision games,
had the overlay system. Right.
And the overlay system not only had what buttons to press, but also it gave you information, because you could see on there, like on Utopia, it showed you, I mean, it's coded for the items that show up on the screen are coded with what a school.
Absolutely. Oh, that's.
And when you're playing Sea Battle, you know, when it go to battle, you see the ship the other guy has. You go, what is that? Oh, you look at your hand control. You say, oh, that's a battleship. Oh, that's an aircraft carrier group or whatever. So you need that to play the game.
Right.
Well, here's the DS. There you
go. Right.
They're giving us the overlay system. That's terrific.
And it doesn't interfere with the game, because you can put the game on the top and you got the overlays
exactly.
on the bottom.
Exactly. So.
Oh, Drew, you got one over there.
Yes, we've got it on display here. We looked at that and we said, we've got to do it. Now, the problem was, in general, the publishing market looked at DS and looked at PSP coming out and saying, DS isn't going to go. DS is going to be a system where we're not really sure we want to support it.
Yeah, coming around now, though.
So we knew the DS was going to be a soft sell for us. So we didn't, unlike the other stuff, we didn't try to go to a publisher and say, hey, why don't you license this? Instead, we financed the development ourselves.
Good for you.
We said, we wanted to have these overlays. We wanted to have the Wi-Fi.
Wi-Fi support, of course.
We wanted all of that in this thing.
Sorry, gotcha.
And so instead of going to a publisher and getting some compromise thing, we said, we're going to do it ourselves. We're going to do it the way we want to do it. So
Sweet.
We paid for it. So we, and it's almost done. It's probably got another 2 or 3 weeks of tweaking around, of adding some graphics on the overlay, of doing, but we really worked with the company. We worked directly with a company called Sensory Sweep. We picked them because they had already had. We picked them because they were the one company we found that had already finished and released a DS game. They did Tiger Woods Golf.
Tiger Woods is a great game, too.
And we looked at it and we said, okay, these guys have the experience, they have the know-how. Plus, when I went there and visited the place, I looked around, yeah, this place is a lot like Mattel was back in the 1980s. It's a crazy place. These guys are nuts. Dave Rushton, who runs the place, owns the place, his kids work there, and they have kids, and there's like play pens and toys all over for the kids that are running around the office. It's a real family, you know, crazy fun place. I said, this really reminds me of any place I've seen. This place most reminds me kind of the craziness that we had at Mattel. I said, and I met the programmers, and they were young Intellivision fans, and they were enthusiastic. And I said, this is a group that I think that we can work with and get this done. And they've done a fantastic job and really have worked hard to duplicate the, you know, to get the emulator going. And again, it's based on our emulator off of the Windows one that Steve Roney
worked on.
And
excellent.
So, you know, Steve Roney he's our VP of software development.
Right.
So he's been in contact with them constantly and making sure that the emulator is up to snuff. Got great
okay,
sound.
How many games do we got? Give me the
42.
Number. Oh, sweet.
42 games is the current count. There's a couple. There's one or two that might be added or taken away, or we're still kind of playing with it a little bit.
And what's the what are the basic games? You got the real sports games?
It's got all the it's got the sports games. In general we've used the INTV versions that have one or two player. Because I mean it's like, see, this was the mistake that I think Activision did when they came out with their version for the PlayStation. They said, oh well, we want the version of baseball that sold 1 million copies.
Right.
And we said, well, that's a two-player only version. Why not use World Championship Baseball that used the program from the original one but added this to it? They go, well, how many did that sell? Well, that sold through INTV Corporation, probably sold 20 or 30,000. No, we want the one that sold 1 million.
You go,
and so a lot of the games that were in that PlayStation version that Activision came out with were two-player only games.
That's
no one wants that. So we went with all the things, one or two player. You know, some of the games like boxing and Sea Battle are only two player, but in the sports ones we picked up the one player versions of stuff. So it's got all of those. It's got all every sports game is every space game is in there.
We got the speaking ones, the
every
voice
space
ones.
That's one thing that we're still
trying to decide.
Trying to get making sure that the voice is working. But right now B-17 Bomber seems to be working Space Spartan seems to be working. We still have a question on Bomb Squad.
Space Battle.
But Space Battle's in there. Astro Smash is in there.
Man, I played crap out of that game.
They're all in there. The games we kind of left out. We left out Math Fun and Word Fun. We left out, Learning Fun 1, Learning Fun. We left out, I'm sorry. I'm sorry for people who wanted to use the DS to educate their kids, but we left out the education.
You know what? That might, looking back, that might be a mistake. Have you been following the brain games from in Japan?
Yeah.
That's like the number two game.
I know.
Overall.
I know.
Consoles.
And there's actually some fun little concentration and mind type of games.
I got a demo from E3. I lost my mind. That's the coolest thing ever, answering questions. I said, this is going to be it. So they're going to bring that over. So that gives you something to release for Volume 2.
Well, it also gives us something for PSP, because Sony always likes to see, what are you giving us that you don't need to give them? Well, how about this game?
Well, you can have Math Learning.
That's
okay,
right.
Is he ready? You keep sending him away. Homies here are going to be here all day. I can send him away and I can come back and get him. All right. I want to make sure we get to talk about the new cartridges. Let's move on to that. Let's talk about the new cartridges.
Right.
I'll come and pick you about the DS later.
Right.
So you got two brand new Real Intellivision cartridges.
Yes.
Give us the scoop.
Okay. Well, from the very beginning, people have asked us, in fact, that was one of the very first things we looked at when we first, even before we were looking at doing the Intellivision Lives in 1998, there was this game, Super Pro Pool and Billiards, which had been completed at INTV Corporation, but had never been released, and Dave Warhol's group Real Time had never been paid for it. So Real Time owned it. So this was before we bought the rights to the Intellivision stuff from the old INTV Corporation. There was this one game that Dave Warhol had for the Intellivision, and we started investigating, could we make a new cartridge? Well, the people who had made the cartridge before for Intellivision, they had destroyed all of the special stuff that you need to make it. Because
right.
See, that's the problem. The Intellivision games, unlike an Atari 2600 or ColecoVision game, where you can just burn an EEPROM, put it in a board, and plug it in, and it works, the Intellivision games had, the ROMs had built-in latches, because the same address, the same lines were used for addressing and data retrieval. So they would shoot the address out to the cartridge, latch the information, the data would shoot back over the same line, plus each individual, that would be made up of multiple pages, multiple chips. Each chip knew its own address. It had addressing within the chip.
Right.
So the Intellivision would say, I need something from the 5,000 block of data. The chip out there, you had a 5,000 block and a 9,000 block, whatever. The 5,000 block knew, oh, that's me. And so it would latch the address, would get the data. So the chips were more than simply ROM chips. You couldn't just put an EEPROM in them. So We just found that economically we couldn't do it, so we didn't. And then as time went by, some people started figuring out, we could do this, we can build latches this way and everything. And they came to us and said, hey, we could build an Intellivision cartridge. Well, how much would it cost? Well, wholesale cost would be about $40, and we're going to sell them for $50. We're going, well, that's not exactly
kind of margin we're looking for.
That's not exactly makes it worthwhile. But we're constantly talking to people, constantly looking at the new technology. We're always looking, what can be done? And we started talking with one group about a year ago. They actually contacted us because they saw the TechnoSource plug and play. And they were saying, we think we could put a 1610 onto a chip thing and everything. And it would just cost you $500,000 something you could tool up. And we go, we can't afford to do that. But I said, boy, if you could figure out a way to make new cartridges, we'd be interested in that. And they came back to us like a month later and said, yeah, we figured it out.
Nice.
And how much would it cost? It cost about $650 a chip.
Wow.
And now you're talking. Now nice. The other guys were doing it for $40 or whatever. And then we looked in the cost of making new casings and new packaging and everything. I said, we can probably do this for around, we can probably do this, at a price that we could sell for $25. If we can make all of this for about, get all the packaging and everything for about $10-$15. Because we're talking about low numbers. We're talking about doing like 500.
Yeah, right.
Because that's how many, some of these collectors think, you do that, you'll sell 20, 30,000 of them. No. We'll sell 500 of them. That's how many people actually have real Intellivisions and really want these things. So in order to get to the numbers we needed, we figured, we need to sell about 4,000 to break even. But that could be 8 different titles of 500 each to get to that. So we looked at the unreleased games and everything, and we said, well, we've got these unreleased games, and we got a couple of unfinished games we could probably finish, and a couple of the programmers from back then said, you know, there was a game I always wanted to do, and I've never had a chance, and if you could really release a real cartridge of it, I'll program it. So,
wow.
So that's in development. So we are looking at doing 8 new cartridges. We're going to release them 2 at a time. The first 2 are going to be Illusions, which was a game that was done by our French people, our French office in 1983.
Cool.
It was never released for the Intellivision. They did license it to Coleco for a ColecoVision version, but there was never the Intellivision version never been released. It's never been on one of our collections even. And the other one is the Super Pro Pool and Billiards. Now, that has been on our Television Lives collection, but it's never been in a real cartridge before.
It's cool.
And, you know, a lot of the people say there's just nothing like playing it on a real cartridge, on a real Intellivision.
Absolutely.
Well, we're going to provide it for them. So we're going to come out, like I say, over the next year or so, our plan is to release 8 games. And actually, we may wind up doing more because we were talking to people, and there were some games that came out at the end of the INTV cycle. Games like Spiker, Super Pro Volleyball, Stadium Mud Buggies, where people have complained, I just was never able to get a copy.
Right.
And to buy a copy now, it costs $150. There's so few of them or whatever.
Same.
And we're saying, we weren't really planning on that, but we may re-release some
great.
Of the rarer cartridges so people can get one. So
that's great.
But that's what we're doing. We're showing the prototypes are here.
Great.
We're probably 5 or 6 weeks out from actual manufactured ROMs,
that's great. This has been a good time.
Yeah, so we try to cover everybody from the true Intellivision purist who wants a real cartridge to play on the real Intellivision, to the kids who have never seen Intellivision, never seen anything before, and we're introducing the Intellivision. And like I say, we're expanding the Intellivision name. We're releasing music CDs. That's our music and music inspired by video games with the Intellivision name.
That's great
and
stuff.
We're going
all that at IntelliVisionLives.com.
Yes, indeed.
All right.
Yes,
thank
indeed.
You, Keith. I
thank
really appreciate
you, very much.
You coming over. It's great stuff.
You bet.
Good
you
time.
Bet.
I'm going to come over and get some flair.
Okay. All right.
Come over and see the DS version.
And play the DS.
I want to play the DS version. Thanks again.
Thank you.
Appreciate it.
Sure.
We'd like to thank Keith Robinson for spending so much time with us at the Classic Gaming Expo 2005. I personally found it one of the best interviews we've had. Great guy, gave us lots of time. Very exciting things on the horizon from the boys over at Blue Sky Rangers. Look for more information soon right here on Retro Gaming Radio. This month's 8-bit flashback is going to be a surprise to a lot of you. Most people know that I haven't really been into Nintendo very much until recently with the GBA SP and the DS. However, I did for a brief stint own an original Game Boy as my primary gaming system. And this month's 8-bit flashback, I'd like to take a look at a game that will forever burn in my memory. And that is Tetris on the original Game Boy. Now, it came with mine as a pack-in. Now, I don't remember if they had a Game Boy available without Tetris. But when you bought Tetris, the Game Boy, you got Tetris with it. And I thought that was a brilliant move. Probably the first, maybe second best pack-in next to Donkey Kong on the ColecoVision. And just to give you a little backstory, you guys love the stories, and I haven't told a good story in a long time, so I've got a good story tied around this one. When I was in the Navy, obviously portability was a big thing, right? I mean, if you've ever been on a submarine as a visitor, you know, you've ever toured one, if you've ever been deployed on one, you probably know that there's not a whole lot of room down there for the essentials, let alone bringing entertainment with you. Just to give you an idea, we called our bunks coffins because they were roughly the size of a coffin. Underneath your mattress was a small, I'd say maybe 6-inch deep pan, and that's what you got to stick your crap in. That's all the room you had. Clothes, toiletries, books, magazines, you know, anything that you were going to bring along with you had to fit inside that compartment. Now, if you were clever and you had a little seniority on the boat, there were other places to hide stuff or to put things away where people couldn't find them. So you could, you know, inevitably bring a few more things on board. And there's always some unused storage facilities that some people don't know about. But all in all, you basically had, you know, 6 feet by, 3.5 feet by 6 inches deep to store all your crap. So now you got to understand, folks, this is back a long, long time ago when things were big. You know, my CD player was huge, you know, my quote portable CD player. You weren't bringing along portable DVD players back then. I mean, nowadays, you know, going underway on a submarine would be nothing. You have your portable DVD player or your portable, you know, movie playing device. You'd have, you know, your Nintendo DS, your PSP, whatever. You'd be all set. You know, you could put a whole lot of entertainment in that little tiny space. But back then, you know, Game Boy was it. And so I went ahead and I thought to myself, you know, I'm going to be deployed for like 6 months. I really need to have some form of entertainment. So I went whole hog and bought a Game Boy, the original black and white Game Boy. For those of you who might be somehow visualizing a Game Boy Advance, no. Original black and white Game Boy, power adapter, link cable. I didn't even know what I was going to use it for, but I bought one anyway. And four or five games, I think, at the time is what I ended up buying. So I had a pretty decent set. And that Game Boy kept me busy for a long time. I really wasn't playing much Tetris at the beginning because I had, you know, Super Mario, I had Kirby, I had several games that were, you know, had an objective in mind. Not an endless game, but games that you would play to the end and be done. And so I played through Super Mario, I played through Kirby, and I had a great time. I mean, despite the fact that literally, folks, if you haven't actually touched a black and white Game Boy recently, not an emulator, no. I'm talking about an actual black and white Game Boy. Put your hands on one and actually seen how bad the screens are. I mean, they're really bad. The ghosting, the poor, I mean, it's bad. It's bad. Emulation makes the Game Boy look like a great machine, but let's be honest, it was pretty bad. Yet somehow the Game Boy managed to win the wars. Who knew? But anyway, so I'd finished all my games. I think I'd actually finished Mario twice at this point in time. So finally I turned back to Tetris. Now, as a single-player experience, you know, Tetris was okay. It's standard, you know, falling brick. We all know what Tetris is. It's pointless to go into the great detail. But in reality, what made Tetris so great, aside from the fact that it was a pack-in, you didn't have to pay for it, was the fact that it had a two-player mode. And this was one of the absolute first games, at least that I can remember, and I'm sure I could go back and research this, but as far as I can remember, this was the only two-player simultaneous game around at the time. I mean, there were more later, you know, briefly later, but right at the time, this was it. And I'd never experienced that before. I'd never hooked a Game Boy up to another Game Boy. I had the cable, but I never really had anybody to play with. Now, I know what you're thinking. You're thinking submarine, there's like 150 guys on there. How do you not know who else has a Game Boy? There's a little story behind that. For anybody who's been in the military, this will probably, or the submarine force, will bore the crap out of you. But some people will find this interesting. When I was deployed, I went through boot camp and all that other good stuff. And once I got to the submarine, I was assigned to a submarine that was in dry dock. In other words, they pull the boat in to this big container. They drain all the water out of it, and the sub sits on blocks. I mean, this thing is huge. I mean, it's not like you're putting a fishing boat or trawler up, you know. This is, like, huge, these blocks, and the submarine is just unbelievably big. But so you go in dry dock, and they retrofit all of your parts. I mean, they change out this system, they change out that system, they replace all of this, they replace all of that. Normally, it takes, like, a year. Well, our particular boat was having problem after problem after problem, and so the boat was there for, like, 3 years. Well, one of the biggest things, and I'm sure every military has something like this, whenever you enter into a specialty field like submarines, there is a great push for you to get some training, to get qualified. Now, you ever watch on like Hunt for Red October, whatever, if you look at the guy's medals, you know, the medals on the side of his uniform, on the top chest, top left chest, you'll see like these little metal insignias. On the submarine, they're called dolphins. They're two little dolphins jumping around a ship. When you first go to a submarine, your absolute first goal, before anything else, before sleeping, before eating, is to get those little fish. In order to do that, it's a huge process. You've got to go and kiss a lot of ass. You've got to study a lot. You have to know basically everything about the submarine. And you go to specialists on the sub to get these fish. And it's a long process. And it's a real pain in the butt. But you're basically scum. I mean, hazing is alive and well in the military. Trust me. They may have, you know, taken it out of colleges, but trust me, it's still there in the Navy. So in order to expedite that, I was sent away from my boat to another boat that was actually out at sea. It was actually a boomer boat, for those who are curious, a ballistic missile sub. So when I got on board, I knew nobody. Really. I mean, I was assigned temporary active duty to this other boat, and I spent 4 months underway with them, you know, which really ends up being more like 6 months because, you know, you have a month before you go over, a month when you get back. It goes out of Holy Loch, Scotland. It was a nightmare. So I got to the boat. I didn't really know that many people. You learn and you meet the people that are in your division, but the other people on the boat know you're not one of them. You know, it's weird. It's a social, it's a social thing. But anyway, so I really didn't know anybody at first. And when you get underway, you know, you're getting used to being underway for the first time, you're doing your job, you're getting qualified. And as I started meeting people through the qualification process, I found another guy that had a Game Boy. Now, he also, of course, had Tetris because it was a pack-in. So we decided one time, you know, we got to, you know, got to know each other, and we had some odd shifts, so we didn't really get a chance to play. But finally, we got to the point to where things settled down, and while we were underway, we managed to get together and play this Tetris. And I'm telling you, this was coming from a person that really believes that multiplayer games should be played together in the same room, if at all possible. That the best times in my life, if you ever listen to my Realms of Impossibility review from a really old episode, if you've ever listened to what were some of the other games that were like that. But I've talked a lot about it. There's something about being in the same room. And this is why people drag their computers over to other people's houses and have LAN parties. This is why, despite no matter how good online gaming gets, there is still a draw for people to grab their box, grab their PlayStation 2, grab their Xbox, grab whatever, and go to somebody's house with a whole bunch of other geeks, all plug in, jack into the same thing, and play. Because there's a social element to it. It's not something that can be recreated online. It's not something that can be recreated with in-game chat. It's not the same thing. And anybody who knows what I'm talking about understands. For those of you who don't know what I'm talking about, I mean, you probably grew up never actually playing in the same room with another person. I kind of understand that, and I pity you. Because, quite frankly, the social aspect of playing Mario Party with a group of four people sitting in a hotel room after CGE in the middle of the night, there's something special about that. There's something endearing and bonding about that. And Tetris on the Game Boy was the very first opportunity that I had to experience this since, you know, the old days of computing, the older days of, you know, playing on the Commodore 64. You know, PCs were starting to come into their, you know, come into the groove, and so a lot of people were on PCs. But this was the first time that there was a portable solution to gaming together, at least that I know of. And it was magic. I mean, it's still Tetris. It's just Tetris. I mean, not even like Tetris DS, where you've got push modes and mission modes, and you've got weapons and all of this other extraordinary. This was just Tetris. This was falling block, no modifiers Tetris. No ghost piece either, I might add. For those of you who listen to Dual Screen Radio, you know what I'm talking about. But no, this was a magical time. And he and I mean, by the way, this cable, let me just paint you a picture, because a lot of people listening may not understand this. This cable was not long, folks. You had to be almost sitting in each other's lap, which is why later on with the Game Boy Advance, the cables got a little longer. And when the DS came about, the concept of playing wirelessly didn't impress a lot of people. But those of us who've ever been tethered to another person with like 2.5 feet of Game Boy cable, it's like being let out of prison. But it didn't matter, you know. We're close on the sub, you know. Don't take that the wrong way, but we're close on the sub. That doesn't mean that you're having a lot of fun when you're basically doing, you know, leg lock sit-ups together playing, you know, Tetris DS or a Tetris Game Boy. Sorry, a little slip of the tongue there. Got the DS in front of me. It just happens. But anyway, from a gaming standpoint, let's be honest. I mean, it was just Tetris, but the social aspect of it. And this was one of the first games, too, that I had seen where it wasn't a cooperative play. This was one of the first games I saw multiplayer, at least in a recent time period. I mean, there are competitive games out there. You know, Dr. J and Larry Bird go one-on-one. You know, that was a good competitive game that you played two players simultaneously at the same time. But in this case, it was a game that rewarded you. It's not like you were seeing who could last longer or who could score the most blocks. Those would be logical things for Tetris to do. But in this case, it was a matter of trying to dick over your buddy, and that was way cool. And the new version of Tetris on the DS, of course, follows that same, you know, moniker where you're dropping, the more lines you clear at one time. You clear one line, nothing happens. But if you clear two lines at the same time, three lines, four lines at the same time, your opponent gets sent some odd bricks on the, that pushes all his bricks up on the screen. And the whole time I was playing Tetris alone in my bunk, my coffin, the whole time I was playing it, that element of it never quite fit in. It was Tetris. You sped up, next level, sped up a little more, next level, sped up a little more, dead. That was it. And it was fun, don't get me wrong. But once you threw in that extra player element, and the guy's sitting right there, you call him a bastard, you call him a sumbitch, you smack him, you know, for sending you blocks. It was amazing. And to this day, that is one of my fondest memories, my earliest, first memory of portable gaming. And it didn't come from the Atari Lynx, which is what I tout all the time. You know, I always talk about how great the Lynx is and how great the game ports were and how beautiful the screens were, how short the batteries lasted. But no, in all honesty, despite the fact that early generation Nintendo stuff, for the most part, pissed me off, the Game Boy Tetris was magic. And to this day, it remains one of the absolute best pack-ins. It remains one of the best versions of Tetris, if nothing else due to its simplicity. Its power and simplicity. And I'll be honest with you, you know, I would still play that today. If I had a Game Boy laying around, I would still play it. I've got it sitting on my Nintendo DS Supercart, so I can throw it up there. It's got a Game Boy emulator built in. I can actually play the original Tetris. There's something magical about the first time that you carry around with you entertainment. And this is something that Generation Gimme can't get a paw on. They can't get their hands around. They can't bite into. There was a time when there was no way to play video games on the go. I want you to think about that for just a minute. At some point in time, there was no way to put something in your pocket. A cell phone, a handheld, a BlackBerry, a DS, an SP, a Game Boy Advance, a PSP, whatever. These things did not exist. You did not game on the go. The best thing you could do is stick a computer in your bag and take it to somebody's house. That was gaming on the go. Understanding that the Game Boy, while completely technically inferior to anything else that came after it, except for maybe the Game.com, bazing, no, you got to understand, this was the first time. This was being introduced into a completely new medium. And I think that's why Game Boy made it. Aside from the fact that later on, if you have not revisited as a classic gamer, it would behoove you to go back and look at some of the old Game Boy titles just to see how good they were doing at the end. A lot of people don't know how long the Game Boy was around, man. With the Lynx and the Game Gear and the Nomad and everything else on the planet stepping up, the Game Boy endured. I'm not saying it's all about Tetris. I'm not saying that Tetris was the reason that the Game Boy endured. But I think that Nintendo was brilliant in the marketing of Tetris. Tetris has become, since then, the pinnacle of casual gaming. And I think that Nintendo didn't make Tetris, but they brought Tetris to the masses in a brand new way. And a lot of people say, well, you know, Shane, you're always bad-talking things that are rehashes or renames or try to take the credit of something that came before. There is innovation in presentation. A lot of people don't get that. And I know it's a fine line, and I know it looks hypocritical. A good example is Grand Theft Auto on the PlayStation Portable. I understand, despite its minor technicality problems, it really is Grand Theft Auto on the move. There is something special about that. The first time you've gotten to play Grand Theft Auto riding the bus to work, there's something special about that. That doesn't mean the Grand Theft Auto itself is a new property, but it's brought to you in an innovative new way, portably. And as I've said before, there are certain titles that work portably that I would never, ever play on a PC or a console. The Sims is a prime example. When you've got a handheld and you're running around with it, what's your goal? You're killing time. If you're out and about and you're down for whatever reason, you're on your way to work on a bus, you're commuting, right? Or you are waiting for a movie to start. Whatever. There are downtimes, and that's why you take gaming on the go. Your goal is not to achieve something. Your goal is to waste time. 15 minutes before the movie starts. 20 minutes on the bus. 3-hour plane ride. Your goal is to waste time. And if all you're supposed to do is waste time, you're willing to suck up a lot of things, like The Sims. I'll play The Sims on my DS. I would never play it on a PC. I'd never play it on a console. But the fact is, Sims is a great waste of time. That's what it's designed to do. There's no goal, except for you to run around, meet people, build your street cred, whatever. Herbs. In any event, Tetris as an arcade game, Tetris as a computer game, which I do believe is where it originated. I'd have to double check on that. But I'm pretty sure it originated as a PC game, as a computer game. That's not nearly as magic as taking it with you. This is an incredible phenomenon, and we've seen a lot of it since then. Everybody wants something on the go. Nintendo gets mad props for being the first people to pull it off. They didn't pull it off well. I mean, like I said, I'll be honest with you. The Game Boy is one of the nastiest devices I've ever seen in terms of screen quality. You know, no colors, black and white. I mean, even the sound was kind of tinny. But they pulled it off. And Tetris was an amazing way of doing it. And Tetris, of course, is one of the most cloned, one of the most recreated games on the planet. There's been versions for every platform, many versions for some platforms, and it still comes out today. And Nintendo managed to take and expand upon this. I'm going to give my little DS plug, even though I have a whole other show for this. But they reinvented Tetris again on the DS and brought new things to the table. And again, change the way that you play Tetris. In this case, there is no more 2.5-foot cable. You want a partner? Hop on Wi-Fi. You have a partner. Again, it's not the same as being there. It's not the same as having your Navy buddy sitting next to you where you could smack him around for sending you four, you know, Tetramino rolls. It's an amazing thing to take a moment and reflect how far we've come technologically. Not just from a technological point of better graphics, better sound, but how we've evolved, how we've taken things with us, how we have had a mad push for portability. You know? A lot of people didn't even think about it until the Game Boy kind of came out and said, hey, did you know you could do this? Have all the fun of a console, have all the fun of your computer game on the go. Just remember that this wasn't always there. Take a moment. One of the things about running a retro gaming radio or a classic gaming radio show is the fact that a lot of people listening have never experienced life without portable entertainment. Okay, you got your cell phone now, right? You can watch video on it. You can play a half-assed version of Tetris, whatever. You could do that now. And a lot of people can't remember a time when you couldn't. Imagine being around and being part of the original Game Boy. Imagine being the guy, one of the guys, the first guys that anybody knew that had one of these things, that you could actually play Tetris on the go. It's insane. It's just an insane thing. And I have to step back and marvel at it, because we have become so sloth-like as a society. We just expect it. Next handheld better have realistic 3D polymorphic graphics, blah, 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 blah. Yeah. There was a time we didn't even have portable entertainment. It's like one of those old fogies that say, you know, we didn't have school buses. We walked through the snow uphill both ways to school, to and from school. But it's true. And you gain a much bigger appreciation for progress once you've had an opportunity to think about and go back and revisit these things. And that's kind of what's cool about this job. I got to go back and play the original Tetris, and I get to talk about it. And you guys get to hear about it. It's way cool to me. It's way cool. If you haven't had an opportunity, I mean, honestly, if you're a real retro gamer, if you're really into classic gamers and you've never had a Game Boy, go to eBay. Go find your local pop culture store. Go to a yard sale. Pick one of these things up just to have as a symbol of how far we've come. It's amazing. It's truly amazing. By the way, as soon as I pulled into port, the Game Boy got sold. I got to finish the story now. I had a lot of good times with it, but as soon as I pulled into port, as soon as we got back home, the Atari Lynx was out, and I'll be honest with you, the Atari Lynx stole my heart. And I went the Lynx way. I sold my Game Boy, all my games, everything. I can almost remember who I sold it to. Isn't that creepy? I mean, that was a long time ago. But anyway, so I sold that. I picked up an Atari Lynx, and I was enchanted with it, despite the fact that it burned through 6 AA batteries in 2-3 hours. That's what the D battery pack was for. I looked like a Borg carrying around this freaking giant 6D battery pack clipped to my belt. But you know what? It's what I wanted. And it wasn't just because the graphics were better. The games were realistically... It didn't have Tetris, but it had Clacks, which I fell in love with. It had Road Blasters, which is one of my absolute favorite handheld games, because it was so good. It was so perfect to the arcade. This is not a review about the Atari Lynx, though. Suffice to say, I never did pick up anything Nintendo after that. Not for a long time. That was the end, by the way. A lot of people's like, well, you know, did you always hate Nintendo? No, I didn't. In fact, I liked the Game Boy for the brief time I had one, until the Atari came out and kind of showed me what the DS, whew, talk about a one-track mind, what the Game Boy was missing. You know, the vibrant colors, the beautiful backlit screen. Let's be honest, you weren't playing the Game Boy in the dark. So that was something that was important to me. I was underway a lot, and I didn't want to have a light on in my bunk all the time. So the Atari Lynx was perfect. I could play it in the dark, and believe me, I did. But that's a whole nother story. Anyway, I think a lot of people would find this 8-bit flashback interesting, because I have always been the non-champion of the early Nintendo days. And I think it's important for people to know that, yeah, I did have a slice of Nintendo history back then. And it was good. It was a sweet history, and there was a lot of fun involved with it. And I think, from a historical perspective, that the Game Boy itself, the original Game Boy, is a testament to Nintendo's ability to bring to market what it needs the most and when. You know, I really do. And I'm kind of a believer. Now, Nintendo's made mistakes just like everybody else. You know, the Virtual Boy, and a lot of people didn't even like the N64. I was not a huge fan, but had a couple of games I enjoyed on it. Suffice to say, a lot of people have discarded Nintendo as a player. You know, everything is Xbox, everything is PlayStation, everything is Sony, everything's Microsoft. But, hey, Nintendo's been there at the forefront every single time since then. With something different. Analog controller, real 3D platforming, the DS, you know, first touchscreen, first, you know, dedicated gaming touchscreen. There's just so many ways to talk about it. But I do want to let people know that I did have a piece of, you know, Nintendo Kana back in the old days, and that Tetris is still today one of the most important pieces in our gaming history. Certainly the most important in portable gaming history. I don't think anybody could deny that. But anyway, well, I hope you enjoyed the 8-bit flashback. We'll get back to more Commodore stuff. in the next show, but I wanted to take a moment to sort of take a departure and let people know, especially at a time when, you know, Tetris DS is so popular, it's nice to go back and talk about origins. You know, where things came from is important. And this is my opportunity to do that. So, hope you enjoyed the 8-Bit Flashback. Tune in next month for more 8-Bit goodness right here on Retro Gaming Radio. Well, folks, I think that's going to wrap up this edition of Retro Gaming Radio for May 2006. Hope you guys had a good time, and hopefully this show more or less made up for last month's Greatest Of show. This summer, of course, as I mentioned before in the show, this summer we've got tons of great stuff lined up. We're going to play for you that incredible interview with Howard Scott Warshaw, which is absolutely some of the best stuff of the last Classic Gaming Expo we attended. We've got tons and tons of new stuff coming up this summer. Some stuff I don't want to quite let out of the bag just yet, but some very exciting stuff. We're going to have a couple of accompanying videos for the future episodes, probably post them on Google Video or whatever. Things that are just absolutely outstanding that will complement the show. Not that we're going to try to diversify into video all the time, but there's some things that radio just doesn't work for, but at the same time I want to share with you. So we got tons of good stuff coming up. With no Classic Gaming Expo this year, we're going to be relying a little bit more on doing some phone or Skype type communications. And yes, once we get back into the fold here, we're going to get back into doing some more of those user phone calls through Skype and through Google Talk. We didn't have a lot of time this last month to get that rigged up, but next month I'm hoping we'll have more time to do that. In any event, big thanks to speedhost.com for hosting our show, Zacuum.com for hosting a lot of mirrors and whatnot for us, and big thanks to you, the listeners. We keep getting new listeners every single day, and don't forget, the Year 7 Retro Gaming Radio DVD-ROM should be out here shortly. I just need to finish compiling up the shows. I've got tons of bonus material I've dug up, some very special stuff from the cast of Retro Gaming Radio that'll be included. Good stuff. I think you'll like it. Keep an eye out on the website for pre-ordering. Of course, we'll probably be pre-ordering sometime in June for delivery in July, as pretty much per normal. We like to do this just before Classic Gaming Expo, which there isn't one this year. But trust me, I have ways of getting interesting information for you guys. So do not despair. Retro Gaming Radio is still going strong. And for those of you who are big into the Nintendo DS, don't forget the sister show hosts myself and Chris Henschel, where we talk about the best of the Nintendo DS and our dual screen radio show at dualscreenradio.com. Once again, thanks for everybody to contribute to our show through the Bits and Bytes news form submitter on the website. Lots of good stuff came through this month, and we always look for your great bits and bytes to talk about right here on Retro Gaming Radio. Well, I think that'll wrap it up, folks. This is Shane R. Monroe saying, until next time, keep it retro.